Good evening, it's 6:30. The Murray State Racers lost their first game of the season last night, but it doesn't take away from their record-setting year. Tonight, we'll hear about another record-setting basketball team from 60 years ago, plus more on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe, and this is Front Page PM, our weekly evening news magazine, taking time to talk to leaders and dig into issues in our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM Friday mornings at 8:35 and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. Tonight, we travel to Dover to see how a small community is uniting behind a celebration of the U.S. Civil War, plus a look back at the 1952 state champion Cuba Cubs. But first, this week, legislation has been flying around the House and Senate in Frankfort, and somewhat surprisingly, the House and Senate came to an agreement on congressional districts. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett about the happenings in Kentucky State Capitol this week.
Well, we understand the state Senate has now passed a congressional redistricting plan that's been the focus of some arguments over the past few weeks. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we thought earlier this week that congressional redistricting was dead, that it would end up in the court system, the courts would draw the maps. But apparently last night it was resurrected, and the state Senate has already passed a new congressional redistricting map. I've got it in front of me. It's quite interesting. It pulls the first congressional district, that little hook leg, it pulls it up more towards central Kentucky, kind of flattens the second district a little bit east and west, really compacts the 6th district, but makes it very Democratic and very safe for Ben Chandler. And in the 3rd congressional district, John Yarmuth doesn't have to worry about eastern Jefferson County at all. It is back in the 4th congressional district, along with parts of Shelby, all of Oldham, parts of Spencer, and on up to northern Kentucky and east of there. So, very interesting map.
So that is the congressional districts. Now, what's going on with the legislative districts and the redrawing of those?
The legislative districts are, they're going to be appealed to the state Supreme Court.
Now, on another topic, Governor Steve Beshear has appointed members to a tax commission. What's this panel going to be doing?
They're going to be looking at a bunch of different ways to reform Kentucky's tax code, which has been done for years and years and years. But Governor Steve Beshear says that people should buckle up their seatbelts this time because this commission is going to actually get something done. Whether you believe that or not, you know, we'll have to see. But basically, they're going to look at ways to increase revenue in the Commonwealth. That probably means that taxes will go up in some areas and will lower other areas. We don't know what those areas are yet, but 22, 23 people were appointed to this commission. Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson is the chair of it. You've got Republicans, you've got Democrats, some Beshear supporters, some people who didn't support Beshear in his reelection, 6 lawmakers. It's a pretty broad coalition that plans to sit down and talk with CPAs and economists and normal people like you and me and figure out how Kentucky's tax code should change.
And there was some mention of a barrel tax. What's that about?
Yeah, the barrel tax is basically a tax for distilleries, bourbon distilleries. And what it is that it's a tax that basically is on bourbon that sits in barrels and warehouses and ages. And it's a property tax. Part of it goes to local areas to build libraries, build schools. The other part goes to the state. And what the distillers want, and Beshear signaled openness to, is turning that tax into a tax credit. The distillers would still pay the tax because it's needed on the local level. But they would get a tax credit for that and would allow them to use the money from that tax credit to make their own capital improvements, improve their distilleries, and improve their warehouses, make those type of capital project improvements that they desperately want.
Well, Governor Beshear, of course, at the beginning of the session, is proposing a constitutional amendment to let voters decide if they want expanded gaming in the Commonwealth. Where do we stand on that actual bill?
Well, that bill is going to have to wait a little bit longer until the legislative filing deadline is today at 4 o'clock. Unfortunately, in the appeal for the legislative districts, it's probably going to go to the state Supreme Court next week. The legislator is actioning that they use the new maps for this election. If they had waited and said, we'll run in our old districts for 2012, but in 2013 and 14 we want to run in our new districts, that would probably mean we would still see the bill next week. But because we're not doing that, it'll probably have to wait and see until the court case is completely done with legislative redistricting. Lawmakers just are kind of nervous about sticking their neck out on this issue if they think that they'll get primary opposition or opposition at all. And until legislative redistricting is absolutely done, Beshear's probably going to sit on the bill. That being said, a broad coalition was unveiled yesterday, business leaders, union leaders, education groups, who say that, you know, regardless of how we all stand on casinos and casino gambling, we believe the issue should be on this fall's ballot, and encourage lawmakers to pass the bill that would allow the amendment to go on the ballot this fall to let Kentucky voters decide whether or not to approve it.
And also, there's been some grumbling, some complaints about the management of the Medicaid program in Kentucky. What's going on there?
Yeah, a lot of problems in that area. Of course, we have three new managed care organizations that are statewide: Coventry Cares, WellCare, and Kentucky Spirit. They were instituted November 1st is when the program went in. And, you know, a lot of providers, doctors, pharmacists, your local hospitals, a lot of rural hospital executives that deal with a lot of Medicaid patients basically told a state Senate committee this week that the problems they are facing are catastrophic. The pharmacists have said before that if things don't change on reimbursements, they'll go out of business. Hospital executives were saying that millions of dollars, and doctors were saying millions of dollars in back payments for claims, they're still waiting on those. And senators were pretty sympathetic with it, saying, you know, we have to have you all up and operating. These problems have to be resolved. And the governor said that he's confident they will be. Of course, this week, Janie Miller, the secretary for the Cabinet of Health and Family Services, who would oversee Medicaid, she resigned. But I talked to the governor, and he said, listen, these problems are not new. We knew they were coming. They happened with Passport, you know, almost two decades ago. We're going to work through them. We're going to resolve them. And we'll find out a little bit more about how much they're going to get resolved, because next week the MCOs are basically going to have to camp out here in Frankfort. On Monday they have to report to one committee. I think the House is looking to have them report. Another Senate committee is having the actual Coventry Cares, WellCare, and Kentucky Spirit representatives come to their committees and report on their side of the problems. So it's a big issue. Lawmakers want it under control, but it seems to be going through a lot of tough growing pains right now.
Kenny Colston is the Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS Newscast, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org. The Murray State Racers may have lost to Tennessee State last night, ending its best start ever, but it isn't the end of its storybook season. And amidst the basketball fever sweeping the Jackson Purchase, one area high school took time out to celebrate some former Western Kentucky basketball greats. 60 years ago, the Cuba Cubs, a small Graves County high school basketball team, took the Commonwealth by storm with an unlikely march to the state championship. Graves County High School celebrated that 1952 championship season during halftime of a recent basketball game and invited some of the players from that team to come to be honored. Gary Pitts attended the celebration and sat down with the players to reminisce about their rise to glory.
Tonight we're honoring the 1952 Kentucky Boys Basketball State Champions, the Cuba Cubs of Graves County.
Cuba High School was small by almost any standard. Though it had just been consolidated with nearby Pilot Oak High School, total enrollment in 1952 was around 100 students. But as the school, the state, and even the nation would come to find out, it only takes a handful to field a basketball team. In 1947, Jack Story took over as high school principal and as the basketball coach. He immediately took notice of a group of 8th graders getting ready to move up to the high school and saw a core of players he felt could be special.
He was so far ahead of everybody.
That's Howie Crittenden.
He's the reason for us even still being remembered by the very old people around here.
Crittenden is remembered by most as one of the all-time Murray State Racer greats. He's a member of the Kentucky Basketball Hall of Fame, but he played his high school ball at Cuba. Crittenden is part of that core that began playing together early on. He remembers Coach Story sat them all down and showed them a video unlike anything they'd ever seen before. It was the Harlem Globetrotters.
We all went nuts. Begged him to show it again. He showed it 3 times in a row. Then he said, You boys get out there on the gym floor and see if you can learn to do that.
The handful of eighth graders gathered up by Coach Story started working toward that goal, trying to do what the Globetrotters were doing. And while much of what they did was for show, some of the moves helped them to develop fundamental skills that would lead to their eventual championship.
I think we adapted the character of their style of play. I mean, we played loose, relaxed. Coach Story stressed fundamentals such as ball handling.
Jimmy Webb is another member of that Cuba Cub championship team. He too touts the innovative coaching style of Coach Story. He remembers that every day in practice, the coach would field the five starters against a team of 10, consisting of bench players, managers, and anyone else they could grab.
And I mean, they play for blood, I'm telling you, every day, and that's what we had to compete against.
The team really started to come together during their junior year. In the 1950-51 season, the Cuba Cubs only lost one game during the regular season. They made their way through the playoffs, eventually coming to the championship game. There, they met one of the biggest and best schools in the state, Clark County High. The Cubs lost by 24.
Well, we were let down, and we were all crying, and I think our picture went all over the United States in the newspapers, and I looked terrible.
Julia Harris-Rambo was a cheerleader that year, but it wouldn't be her last chance to cheer for the Cubs in a championship game. The next year, the team that had been playing together since middle school made a strong comeback. Once again, they were in the playoffs. Jimmy Webb remembers the semifinal game as being one of the toughest he'd ever played in. It went into double overtime.
Coach Story said, boys, we got sudden death. That means the first 2 points scored wins the ball game to turn the clock off. Doodle made the shot that won the ball game. That was it.
Charles Doodle Floyd couldn't make the reunion, but was another one of those starters in his fifth year under Coach Story. And once again, the Harlem Globetrotters playing style came through for the Cubs. Howie Crittenden.
Doodle shot his hook shot just like Goose Tatum, and he could flat hit it.
When the Cuba Cubs came into the 1952 championship game, people knew who they were. They were the Cinderella team, and everyone knew about their Globetrotter style of play. As a matter of fact, when they took the floor, Sweet Georgia Brown, the Globetrotters theme music, played over the loudspeaker. Their opponent was Louisville Manual. A school of around 3,000 students, Manual had quite the pull to draw from. But when the Cubs needed it most, the ball handling fundamentals stressed by Coach Story came through.
If we were ahead of a team, I would take care of the ball. They'd chase me. I'd dribble behind my back, between my legs. They'd foul. And at that time, you could choose to shoot your free throw or bring it in from the side. Now, if we got two free throws, we could shoot one, bring the second one in, and keep the ball.
The Cubs got ahead in the game and then controlled it from there. In true David versus Goliath fashion, the Cuba Cubs beat Louisville Manual. When they came back home, they were met by a motorcade at the Eggner's Ferry Bridge and rode back to Graves County in convertible top cars, having made their mark on history. For WKMS News, I'm Gary Pitts.
When we come back, how our roller coaster winter might affect our spring bug population. And we go to Dover to hear how locals unite over a battle that divided the town 150 years ago. This is Front Page PM. This is Front Page PM from WKMS News. We are in the first extended cold snap of 2012 following a warm couple of months. While the cold weather means layering your clothing to keep warm, it also, to some, has historically been a predictor for a normal spring insect population. Entomologist Doug Johnson from the University of Kentucky's Extension Office in Princeton joins me to dig into details of insect population predictions and their coping strategies during the cold months. Dr. Johnson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell me, can the warmer temperatures from January affect our insect population in the spring?
Oh, sure they can. Yeah. Any time the temperature warms up over what we would assume to be a normal or an average temperature for the time can have impact on insects.
Will we see any effects if we have a warm January, but a very cold February, March, and then a normal April, where we'll see a warm-up in temperatures? Will we see a change in insect population, even though we've had a warm January, but a pretty standard cold February and March?
Yeah, you certainly will, because if the January has been warm enough for insects to come out of what we call, generally speaking, their overwintering stage, a stage that protects them from the cold, if they come out of that, they have a very difficult time getting back in, particularly in the short term. So what often happens is it'll warm up And particularly if it warms up over a long period of time and insects come out of their overwintering protection, then a sharp drop in temperature will kill them. They can't get protection from that cold. So you could have a warm-up in the middle of the wintertime, and if it's sufficiently long for them to come out, and then there's a precipitous drop in temperature, you won't see a larger population, you'll see a smaller one.
Insects cope with cold weather many different ways, and sometimes, like you've mentioned, cold weather does not necessarily kill a bug, even though it might look dead. Can you talk about these different types of coping mechanisms that include diapause that makes a bug look dead?
Sure. Diapause is a very specific mechanism that's triggered by something that occurs well before it goes into its overwintering state. Well, actually, it can be overwintering or oversummering. It can actually be through a rainy season or through a dry season. It depends on the insect and where it is. But for us here in western Kentucky, it's primarily one of two things, surviving winter or surviving summer. We have insects that use them for both things. A good example of this is something like European corn borer. When its night length gets to be a certain time, they begin to go into an overwintering stage. And their body will prepare themselves for what it takes to get through the winter, depending upon what they're doing. They'll try to get as fat as they can, as large as they can. Now realize, these animals are not thinking about this. This isn't something that they plan to do. This is a physiological change in what's going on. And one of the other things that will happen is they will begin in their body producing compounds that are called glycols. Glycols are sugars. In fact, people are probably more familiar with them than they think, because the stuff that you put in your car as an antifreeze is a glycol. It's not the same one that the insects use, but it's a similar type thing. So basically, insects manufacture antifreeze, which keeps their bodies from freezing. Now, it's not the cold that kills the insect. It's the manufacture of ice crystals in the cells. That disrupts the cell membranes, and that's what kills the insects. So they'll go into a state of no motion. They'll look kind of waxy, but they're not dead. They're just sitting there, and they're not doing anything. And they won't do anything until the proper conditions occur for them to start to exit that diapause.
Now, some other bugs migrate, similar to birds, correct?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What type of insects do we see migrating that live in our region?
You've got two situations in Kentucky, oddly enough, or maybe not oddly, because we are in the middle of the country. We have a number of insect pests that migrate up from the south. The one that comes to mind is fall armyworm, which can be a tremendous pest of corn, well, all grasses, as a matter of fact, pastures and lots of other things. Of course, its overwintering is done far in the south, and then it would have to get up here sometime in the spring. Black cutworm is another one. And that makes a good contrast. For instance, on a mild winter, black cutworm could overwinter as far north as, say, northern Alabama or southern Tennessee. Where fall armyworm can't overwinter that far north, even in a mild winter, it's going to have to overwinter somewhere down in Texas. So that, in and of itself, puts a window on time when those insects can get up this far north. So they're overwintering by staying further south. And they're trying to come up into the north as time goes on. And, for instance, fall armyworm is called fall armyworm because it was first described in the fall in New England, but it can't live up there. So you have these migrants moving back and forth across the country from places where they can live in either the heat or the cold, depending upon which one it is, or the cold or the wet, and then exploiting areas that are in their range of ability during the part of the season that range occurs.
What about some of these invasive species that we found here in Kentucky, specifically the emerald ash borer, and going back to the climate, is there anything that's going to happen in Kentucky with our climate that could help lower the population of the emerald ash borer?
Well, there's a lot of difficulties associated with introduced insects, and what the emerald ash borer is one of those. They're problematic because they're introduced here by and large without their own natural enemies, essentially insects that feed on them. And so they have no real problem developing very large populations and moving out. Emerald ash borer was introduced into the north. It is a northern prone insect, so I doubt that you're going to see any wintertime condition that's going to make any difference whatsoever to that insect in Kentucky. Whether or not the heat and humidity will have an impact on them, I guess it's still up for grabs, but I don't know the entire range of the insects, so I have my doubts that in a sort of middle latitude state like Kentucky, that's not going to make much difference. Remember, they are adapted to feed on ash trees, so they're adapted to live in the same environment that ash trees are adapted to live in. Therefore, if there are ash trees around, likely that's a good enough environment for them to live in.
And again, Doug Johnson is an entomologist with the University of Kentucky's Extension Office in Princeton, and we've been talking about how our relatively mild January might impact our insect population this coming spring. And again, Dr. Johnson, we've mentioned this, but bears mentioning again that the temperature that occurs in January, the warmer temperature in January, and this now cold snap that we have in these few days of February can impact our population in the spring?
Yes, they will. And the general rule of thumb is if it stays uniformly cold all the way through the winter, or if it stays uniformly warm all the way through the winter, insects will do pretty well, particularly if they're well adapted. Remember, Kentucky is a transitional state. A big change in weather are normal here. It's not an unusual thing. You look back in the historic records and you see very warm winters and very warm summers. Now, there's all kinds of arguments about how often those should be occurring. But the thing that really gets to the insects is when it gets warm and cold and warm and cold and warm and cold. That is very difficult on them, and that will cause populations to drop pretty severely. The one thing that an extenuating cold can cause is not necessarily a larger population of insects, but because of the way insects emerge from their overwintering, if you have a constantly cold temperature and then a relatively quickly warming up, you will find large numbers of them coming out of overwintering at the same time. So it will look like a much larger population. In fact, it may not be. It may just be that it's a large population in a short period of time.
Well, Doug Johnson, again, entomologist with the University of Kentucky's Extension Office in Princeton, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Battle of Fort Donelson took place near Dover, Tennessee, 150 years ago. The battle lasted 6 days, and it didn't surrender to Union forces. Today, residents of Dover are commemorating that battle with a series of events. Rose Kristen Presson visited Dover and spoke with community members about how the town's history has shaped what it is today.
Rosella Village is a retirement home in Dover, Tennessee, but tonight, it's a stage. A group is rehearsing for the Battle of Fort Donelson, a retrospective. The performance consists of four independent scenes depicting various aspects of Dover during the Civil War. The first scene of the retrospective follows the story of Captain Jack Henson, a man with a personal vendetta against the Union Army.
I swore that no blue coat would be safe on Southern soil.
That's Dan Griggs rehearsing the role of Captain Jack Henson. Griggs has been researching Henson since 2005 and has discovered a lot about the captain, including his two sons that were killed by soldiers near where the local McDonald's stands today. He says that when he started, people in Dover didn't even want to hear Henson's name.
Like I said, he had 10 kids, and he lost five of them because of this war, and that's why he went on his revenge, you know, against the Yankee Army, which anybody would have done the same thing. Which to me, I'd have been dead because I'd have faced him head on. He was too smart for that.
Griggs says Henson eventually became a wanted man and lived on the run the rest of his life. Now he's buried in Boyd Cemetery. Griggs says there's a jagged river rock next to his grave, and he thinks his wife Elizabeth is buried there. There's no documentation, but Griggs is more familiar with the life of Captain Henson than possibly anyone else alive.
I love studying him. I like the hard ways to go where nobody else cares for it, and then watch it come out, escalate into what this has.
It's escalated not only into a stage adaptation, but work like this has escalated around the community in a series of Civil War-centered events. A round table, a ball, a ladies' tea, and a fashion show are all happening this month in Dover, concluding with a battle reenactment the first weekend in March in Cumberland City, Tennessee. Jim Morton is a member of Porter's Battery, which is participating in the reenactment.
You talk to people on the street or whatever, and you mention you're a reenactor or you're doing a play or something, they'll mention a relative they had that fought at Fort Donelson, or they had relatives that lived in the area and they saw the troops come through, or they'll always give you a little insight. The community around here, they have a long memory.
The retrospective that debuts this weekend at Rosella Village was written jointly by Martha Parker and Reverend Donald Bailey. Bailey preaches at the Donelson Memorial United Methodist Church, which takes its name from the integral battle. He says he's seen the refocus of the community on the battle in recent years as well.
People have become more aware of the importance of this battle. Up until recently, the Battle of Fort Donelson was, well, it was important, but it was just kind of a small size battle. We realize now that with the fall of Fort Donelson, the South began a retreat from which it never recovered.
Following the fall of Fort Donelson, Union forces took the Cumberland River, the Tennessee River, and were on the border of Mississippi within 2 months. Now, 150 years later, Bailey says the spreading of stories of local heroes and villains and history-shaping events is pertinent for the community. Without it, the foundation on which to build the community's future is weakened, and spreading the word is something Reverend Bailey's good at.
We've been doing this 4 or 5 years now. We started out just doing a one-time thing, and we liked it, and so we've expanded it into some other directions, and I'm hoping it can become an established part of our culture here in Dover.
Bailey and the other members of the theater have enjoyed seeing members of the community come together for this production. Bailey says the more different activities a community can generate within itself, the stronger that community will be.
We're planning to have the cast out to our house Sunday afternoon after the performance for a little cast party, and we just enjoy the friendship of it.
A century and a half after a war dividing the nation, the community surrounding battlegrounds that, according to the National Park Service, saw an estimated 17,000 lives lost, has found friendship, educated their neighbors, and strengthened ties to heritage, history, and each other in Dover. For WKMS News, I'm Rose Kristen Presson.
The Battle of Fort Donelson, a retrospective, runs this weekend at Rosella Village in Dover. Other events taking place that are sponsored by the Fort Donelson National Battlefield can be viewed online at WKMS.org. This has been Front Page PM, our regional news magazine following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM Today, a regular feature at 8:35 Friday mornings. If you'd like to hear any of these or any of our stories, you can find them anytime at WKMS.org. You can also catch us this Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks very much for being here.